Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 2, delivered on January 17, 2013. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. You, woman, I'm going to offer you a deal. I got a dollar here. A dollar. Now, what I would like you to do is get up. I can show you how you can get onto the roof of the State Farm Hall of Business. I'd like you to jump off the roof, land on your feet, and I'll give you a dollar for it. Good? What? This is a dollar. I didn't print it off my printer. It's a real one. You okay with this idea? Why not? Oh, bite me, you know? Really? Look, noob, this is a dollar. And I want you to jump off the roof. It's, what, five stories, four stories? I mean, it's not like you're going to kill your... Well, okay, maybe. But, you know, if you land right, you'll bounce, for God's sake. What's the problem with a dollar for what I want you to do? It's actually what you said. You give me a million, I'm like I have a million. No. The problem is, you see, that there's a risk involved, and your expected return for it, and it's not a return, it's an expected return. I might screw you out of the dollar and say, ah, my bad, I'm not going to give you a dollar. It's your expected return is just not sufficient for the risk you're going to bear. That's one of the most important principles in all of finance, is that the greater the risk you bear, the greater the return you expect. You don't take stupid risks. Okay, yeah, notwithstanding the movie Jackass, in finance, we take as a basic assumption that if you are going to bear a risk, you have to expect a return for it. If there is not an expectation of a return, you're not going to take the risk. Markets work that way. And not only that, they don't just reward you for risk taken. They would reward you possibly for risk that you can't get rid of. There are a lot of risks in this life you don't have to take. You should not expect a reward for those. Now, I must qualify that, because if you go to YouTube and type in the search there, fail, you'll get like 10 billion hits. But other than that, the most important first principle that I can tell you is the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. This is how all financial markets work. This is how your life works. You're not going to do something unless you expect something out of it. You're not going to bear risk if there is nothing in the world that could possibly come of it for you. Now, everyone has a tolerance level for risk. Most people are actually fairly risk averse. Although, I don't know, maybe it's just me. Have you ever met someone in your life who is just a crazy ass mofo? You know, I have. Unfortunately, too many times, I think. You know, there are some people who love risk. They want it. They'll just absorb it. And then most of us say, oh, hell no. It's something like that. So different people, different institutions, different persons have different risk tolerances. For example, you look like you are fairly risk averse. You wouldn't take a risk. Okay, here it is. Have you ever seen that the show Ghost Hunters? Okay, it's a reality show about these guys who go in and look for ghosts. Now, they do things that most people, you go into a house, you open the door, and the house says, get out! Most people are, okay, you know, screw you, I'm moving to another continent. They go on in. You know, and then they get possessed, and then they start issuing ectoplasm, and they start channeling. Okay. But you're not the kind of person who would do that, right? Oh, hell no, neither would I, except that I do it sometimes. You can look up some of my ghost hunting videos on YouTube, which is pretty weird when you think about it, but whatever. Okay, risk, some people take a lot of it, some people don't want to take it. But anyone who takes risk is going to have to be induced to take it. She was certainly not going to take the risk of jumping off a building for just a dollar. But for a lot more, I probably could have talked, I don't know, maybe if I had given her 100. Yeah. I'm not going to give you more than you deserve. I'm not going to promise you more than you deserve. But at the same time, I'll try to make it worth your while to take a risk. When you invest in stocks, some people will take a lot of risk because they expect a high return for it. It's not that they are going to get a high return. Nothing in the future is guaranteed. It's an expectation. So if I ask you, what is the relationship between risk and return? It is the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And this is the key to understanding what finance as a discipline is all about. I don't know of how many of you are going to major in finance. By the time this course is over, I certainly hope that I have scared all of you off. But if you wanted to talk about finance as a career, there are actually three broad areas, and then there's another fourth one that kind of comes off. The book doesn't mention, but it's kind of an important one these days. But here are the three broad areas of finance. And we'll be exploring all of them, but one will be a little bit more of the focus as this course goes along. Okay, the first type of finance that would be important for you to be able to know and to remember for a quiz, hint, hint. Ah, you know what? The first area of finance, the one that will be more the long-run focus of this course is... Really? Let's try this one. The first area is corporate finance. Corporate finance. This is the work inside of a corporation, deciding on what projects to accept, what projects to reject based upon the expectations of future expected cash flows. So in other words, we talk about what are the expected revenues, what are the expected costs, and we see what the balance of those is. And then we decide up or down on the projects. We also do a lot of other things, but it all keys on yes or no, good or bad, go, no go, within the corporate finance world. That's oversimplifying it to a large extent, but that's actually kind of what it boils down to. That's corporate finance. The next one area of finance is institutions. Banks, savings and loans, credit unions, the sources of capital and the flow through agents that ensure that funds go from where they are available to where they are needed. That's institutional finance. And the third area, which a lot of people think of when they think of finance, is investments. Stocks and bonds, exotic instruments, derivatives, and all that kind of stuff. How to buy, how to balance a portfolio, how to determine expectation of return, and how to determine risk that is being taken. Investments is the world that can be a meat grinder. This is the world of the boiler rooms, where you get all these people who dreamed of big jobs and big money in the stock market, and they end up selling stock, calling on the phone day in, day out. Rich people, poor people, middle class people, trying to hawk stock to them, trying to sell this and that, getting clients, getting a commission off what they sell. It is, again, a meat grinder of a world when you start. But there is some money to be made, and we'll talk more about that as time goes along, too. Any of you see the movie, Will Smith's movie, Pursuit of Happiness? It's actually based on a true story, very close to what really happened. One of the few movies that really well depicted it. But that was a story of a person who wanted to get into investments. And that person actually did get in, and he was a big winner. For every winner in this world here, I can guarantee you there are a whole lot of losers. And I've had a lot of them as my students. As a matter of fact, years ago, I ran a penny stock house myself. I actually had a penny stock house, and I was open. I set it up, got everything going. The stock house, my house was open. My brokerage house was open a total of one day before the regulators shut it down. Assholes. Here's that fourth area that really the book, almost inexplicably, kind of like, I think it mentions it a little bit, but it doesn't talk about it as a major area, and it's getting to be a big area. This is the area of, there are a couple of different ways I could talk about it, but personal finance. I'll just call it personal finance. It's the place where you work with people to help them set up accounts so that they can save money, invest money, and build up for their retirement or for plans they have in the future. It's kind of like investments because you are working with people to show them how to invest their money, managing their money. But really, there's more personal in it than in the world where you're sitting at a desk calling people and trying to set up accounts and all that kind of stuff. This is a world where you're talking about people and their goals. Okay, you're making $80,000 a year, and you two are, and you want to plan for having a down payment for a house, and then down the road you want to have kids, and you're probably going to have to help them take care of their ungodly cost of education, and then you want to talk about your retirement. That's this world right there. We actually have people who specialize in that in this college. If you do it well, you can make a great living doing this kind of work. But it also requires a lot of people skills, and it requires a lot of legwork before you finally are in a zone where you're comfortable with your book of business, your commissions that you're making off the clients. But always you're in this sweat situation where you're really controlling people's futures because they're trusting you to make good investments as decisions for them. But these are the four areas. And again, the book talks about these three right here. Doesn't mention much about this, but I'll bring it up a couple of times in this class and show you a few quick exercises where you can think about, okay, well, this is how I would set this kind of an investment up for this kind of a plan in the future for someone and all of that. We'll get to that a little later in the course. For right now, though, it's kind of going to go through a little bit of a potpourri of things. Find someone. You. I need $20. I'll pay you back in 3 months, okay? 3 months, and I'll give you a little bit of interest in 3 months, okay? Now, I'm going to borrow $20 from him for 3 months. In a case like this, I am the seller of a debt instrument, and you're the buyer of the debt instrument. The common person thinks borrower and lender. Don't think that way. in the world of corporate and government debt, literally in the world of personal debt as well, the reality is that when I borrow money from you, I am literally issuing to you, I am the issuer of a debt instrument. And the price that you are going to buy it from me for is $20. You're going to actually, I'm going to just literally write a piece of paper. Here's your damn piece of paper. And for that, you are going to buy that piece of paper for $20 with the understanding that I will retire that piece of paper and the terms of the agreement with some interest on it. So when you are the borrower, you are the seller of debt. Otherwise, we can say that you are the issuer of the debt instrument. Again, the borrower is the seller or the issuer. The lender is the buyer of the debt instrument. Now, we break debt instruments down into three specific kinds based upon the time to maturity of the animal. If it is less than or equal to 1 year, we call it a bill. So in this case, I issued you a bill, and you bought that bill from me. Now, this is contrary to the way people think about bills. Oh, I got a bill in the mail. Well, no, actually, you got notice of your bill that you issued. When you use electricity, there is an electric company that is lending you a service. And as a result of that, they are simply carrying your debt, your bill. And when they send you that thing in the mail, that's your bill. They just wrote it up for you. That's your bill, and you have to pay it. The second variation is from 1 year to about 7, and it kind of varies with who you're talking to about this. 1 to 7 year debt instruments are called notes. These are intermediates. The best example of a note is buying a car, borrowing money to buy a car. In a case like that, you finally have decided that you want your dream car. You want, let's say you want, what's that thing, that boxy thing that's, I can't remember what. Oh, no, let's talk about one of those little smart cars. You know, one of those things that I like to drive over in my car. You know, you ever notice the government doesn't recall for ugly? Anyway, but you want one of those, a little smart car, your own babe machine. Uh-huh, yeah. And so you borrow on a 5-year note, 5 years, you issue and a bank purchases. What do those things cost? I don't even know. If it's over $4,000, it's a ripoff, you know. But anyway, let's say it's 12 grand for one of the things. So what has happened is you issue a note for $12,000. The bank buys that note from you for the $12,000. The price is $12,000. They don't give you the $12,000. They're not stupid. They're going to give it to the car dealer. And then you go ahead and you make payments on it through time, and eventually you realize this car really sucks because, like, I have to use a crowbar to climb out of it, and I just had an accident with a small tree, and the tree destroyed my car and all that kind of stuff. But there you go. You know, it's pretty sad when Volkswagen bugs come by you and beat you up, you know, beat your car up. Okay, but the point, though, is you issued a note. The price of that note was $12,000. By pre-agreement, a bank buys that note from you. And you say, well, wait a minute, I just signed papers. The bank wrote the paperwork up. No, they just did you the favor of making sure that it was everything was right. They wrote up the loan agreement for you, but it's your loan agreement, and then they hand it to you, you sign it, and push it back across to them. Here is my note. Please buy it, bank. The bank says, okay, and they sign it, meaning that they have bought that note from you. So anything that would be between 1 and 7 years, that's going to be a note of one kind or another. Oh, that's something I should probably bring up now. Woman, I want you to read to me. Where's all my $1? Did you get into this? Back, woman, back. Damn, I just got rid of one woman. Okay, here's a $5 bill. I want you to read me what it says at the top of that.
Federal Reserve note.
Federal Reserve note. That animal. Not without dinner and dancing first. Federal Reserve note. It says note, and they're not kidding. Essentially, that is a debt instrument. The U.S. government essentially borrows money from the Federal Reserve. And for that, the Federal Reserve issues a note, meaning that this thing is about 1 to 7 years in duration. That's about the life of one of these things, and then they shred it up. But then the Federal Reserve hands those out. So the government borrows $5 from the Federal Reserve. The Treasury prints up this note. Actually, the Federal Reserve prints it up, meaning that the Federal Reserve was the lender to the government. And as evidence of that debt, they prepare these notes and they hand them out to the public. Okay, it's a note, so it's a borrowing by the government. The government borrows from the Federal Reserve, which happens to be a branch of the government, a part of the government. So how does the federal government pay this note off? Do you know? Gold is way too valuable. Now, you know what they do with this? You know how they get, you know how they do it? Well, I'm going to do this with a, damn, how did I get all this money? Sweet. We're all going to White Castle. Oh, there are no White Castles around here. Okay. So the government borrowed from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve prepared this note on behalf of the government, recognizing the government's debt to the Federal Reserve. So the government owes the Federal Reserve this $5 bill. Owes $5. So how does the government pay it off? The Federal Reserve says, tears it apart, and then issues another one in its place. They paid it off by destroying it and issuing another one in its place. Government says, I want to pay that $5 off. Please tear up that note and prepare another one. Now, do you get it? How we pay our bill? We actually literally simply destroy one debt instrument and have another one printed up in its place. Now, I want you to try that with your bank. But that's how it's done. Okay, the long ones. Long debt. Long debt is called a bond. James Bond. Bonds are the long ones. 7 year, 10 year, 20 year, 50 years. There are bonds out there that are way long, like 100 years. Why would anyone lend money for 100 years? You have an idea? Why would anyone lend money for 100 years? What do you say?
Company, corporation that's going to survive longer.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, that's actually one reason the corporation, by theory, lives forever. Now, not all corporations do, but their lifetimes, they might not need that money back in one lifetime. They could lend out the money to the government or to some big project and not want the money back for 100 years, 500 years. But who would not want money back for 100 years, 500 years? Is there any possible reason a company wouldn't want money back for that long? The answer is that insurance companies, property companies do. You see, because there are there are risks that companies insure, but the possibility of a payoff in one lifetime or even a couple of lifetimes is very low. But over a very long period of time, there's a very good possibility of a payoff. So essentially what an insurance company could do is take premiums for low risk, for low probability of occurrence phenomena, and then they'll invest those in instruments they don't expect to get the money back for years and years, decades, centuries, because there's probably not going to be a chance that they would have to pay out on these insurance policies for that long. An example of that, do any of you know what the New Madrid fault line is? Have you ever heard the term? Well, it's actually right here in this part of the country, there is a fault line, a place where two ancient plates, continental plates, came together. Now, it doesn't make any trouble whatsoever, hardly ever. I mean, but when it does, it is just unbelievable. The last time that the New Madrid Fault caused an earthquake in this part of the country was early in the 19th century. It was so unbelievably powerful that literally the people who were out here at the time described the Mississippi River as flowing backwards. It actually didn't flow backwards. The earth just threw up so hard that the water went the opposite way it should and then started coming back down. Wiped out, flooded, killed lots and lots of people, destroyed the cities and towns that were out here at the time. But that happens very rarely. So if a company wanted to get insured for earthquakes out here, well, an insurance company would say, yeah, we'll take your premiums and we'll invest them in things that don't pay back for a very long time because we don't expect to have to pay out on this insurance, on insurance claims for a very long time. But if we do, it's going to be a doozy, because back then there wasn't a whole lot of activity out here. Now, if we had fault line break or cause trouble, we've got a lot more cities and we have a lot of oil and gas pipelines going through this part of the country. It would be quite a bit more dramatic. Know this about bonds. Now, in your lifetime, you will issue a few bonds, probably. Okay, I'm looking around here. You have finally gotten your degree from this fine institution. And you went out and you found yourself a job as the assistant manager of a Jiffy Lube on the south side of Memphis. You have found yourself a good woman, has five kids from another marriage, and you, on the weekends, you do Elvis impersonations at weddings. Life is good. And you decide it's time to buy a home. So you go and you buy your dream home. That's right. You buy a house trailer. A double wide. You got a double wide wife. Okay? So you got your double wide woman, your double wide trailer, and you got to borrow money to buy it. Well, you're going to borrow that money on a 20-year note, a 20-year bond. You're going to get a mortgage. That means that what you're going to do is issue to a bank, and let's say you splurge on this double wide and you're going for all of the amenities, you know, the skirt that goes around it and maybe a little picket fence and, you know, some other things for it too. So you're going to go with, let's say, 30 grand. You're just going to go for the gusto. Okay, 30 grand, you're going to borrow it on a 20-year mortgage bond. You're the issuer. The bank is the buyer, paying a price of $20,000 to the seller on your behalf. So you are now stuck in Memphis on the south side, working every day as an assistant manager of Jiffy Lube. Your life sucks, dude. I mean, seriously, you shouldn't have done it. But you're stuck. Okay? Here's the thing about personal debt. Corporations issue long bonds just like you did. Except with people, when they make their payments, they're paying the interest for the month and they're paying down the principal, the 20 grand. That's not how it works with corporations and government. They issue bonds just like Key did, and yet with corporations and the government, they never pay the principal until the very end. All they do is pay the interest month after month, or annually or semi-annually or quarterly is the way they do it. But in corporate and in the corporate world and in the government world, the bonds are not being retired, amortized. The principal is not being cut down every month. It just stays there. So a corporation issues 30-year bonds in the amount of $100 million. All it does is pay the interest on that $100 million until the very end, the maturity date. And at the end, it pays one last interest payment, and then it pays off the principal. The bond buyers, the bond holders, the ones who lend the money, have covenants in the agreements to do the lending, to buy the bonds, that ensure that the company is setting aside money in a timely and responsible manner so that they can retire the debt on the maturity date. So the money isn't, it's not like the corporation or the government just sits there until the end and says, oh God, we've got to find $100 million. No, all along the way, there has been this reserve pool that they have been accumulating so that they can retire the debt on the maturity date. But, so if I say that there is $1 million bond, and let's say that the company is AMR, and we'll say that it's an 8%, 30-year. What that means is that for 30 years, every year, the company is going to pay $80,000 every year for 30 years. And then at the end of the 30 years, it'll make one last interest payment, and then it will pay also the $1 million back. That's how corporate and government debt works. It's not like personal debt where that all along you've been cutting down, some of that payment is going towards the principal. So your last payment is just the last payment like it has been all along. One more thing. When you see this 8%, that's how much the company pays every year. In reality, though, most companies pay it in two semi-annual installments. So there would be every 6 months $40,000. Some actually pay quarterly, but the standard is semi-annual. So if you see AMR 8% and you say, well, I'm going to buy that, that would mean that for 30 years, or whatever's left of the 30 years if you bought it in the secondary market, you get a $40,000 check every 6 months until the end. What was I going to tell you? What the hell was I going to tell you about that? Can't remember. There was something really important I was going to say about this, but one way or the other. We'll get back to bonds a little bit more later in the course, but I want to show you something fairly important right now. Let me get back to bonds versus stock. Now, I have a vague sense that most of you kind of have been told this, maybe in Business 100 or in another class, but I have to make it very clear here. Bonds, when a company issues a bond, that's a debt. It represents an obligation to some third party that we have to pay this back. Bills and notes are the same way. Companies have bills all the time. Companies issue notes all the time. But whatever it is, even if it's just a bill for the lights or a bill for some inventory, it is a debt. And debt has to be paid first. Stock represents ownership. Stock represents ownership. And if there is anything left after paying the bills in a timely manner, to the extent that you're supposed to, then the stockholders have claim to it. So in other words, the debt holders have the prior claim to the cash flows. The stockholders, the owners, have the residual claim. If you don't give anything to the stockholders, all they can do is bitch at you. And believe me, as a consultant, that was one of the jobs that I had the unfortunate responsibility of doing is at shareholder meetings when things were going bad, there weren't any dividends being paid or anything like that. They expected me to sit up there and explain why. But I really knew it. What the hell are you going to do to us? Are you going to sue us? Gee, you're the owner. You're going to sue yourself. But the debt holders, if you don't pay them, they can shut your company down. They will. They won't mess around. They won't say, oh, well, maybe next month. No, they will shut you down, especially the bondholders, because they're usually powerful, wealthy institutions and individuals. As I say it, if you don't pay the stockholders, they can cry at you. But if you do not pay the bondholders, they can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox is pretty good as a starter kit. A little advanced, you know. No, I'm serious. I mean, they will. You look on Craigslist, Bible for sale. Comes with dead dog. Then they'll say, loved your mama. That is what happens all the time. You see, that's why you try to stay light years away from pissing off the bondholders, because even if you get close to the point where they start to get worried about their debt, they're going to just start circling the wagons around you and getting ready with Mrs. Fox outfits. And there isn't a tunnel deep enough you can hide your mama in. That's the way it is. And that's why you have companies, and I can give you names of companies right now that are sweating their asses off, worried about these rumors that we are not going to be able to pay our debt holders. Those rumors, if you miss the payment, they just bring their suits in, the lawyers, and they just shut your business down. And then you have to run to a court and get protection from them under Chapter 11, or they will knock, they'll just simply close your doors, because they have the right to, unless a court protects you and works out, and you can work out some agreement with them. And so that's why you have something like Chapter 11, which is essentially just a temporary protection from the bondholders doing what they want to, which is to shut your company down. It's the same thing. If you don't pay your bill on your house, the bank is going to come in and they're going to put you out on the street with your stuff. And it's just the way it is. Well, I'm the owner of this house. No, you're not. You borrowed money. So they have the prior claim. And that's why companies worry when they even get close to the situation. A company like a Best Buy, a company like a Sears, JCPenney, all these companies sweat bullets when they are being talked about in the financial newspapers about their difficulties with cash flow, with revenues. They pray to God that they can have enough money to make the next payment. Speaking as someone who has employed people, you know those people who I hire, when they work for me, I owe them money. If I can't make payroll at the end of the, well, it was 2 weeks with me, at the end of the 2 weeks, I was dead. They could just walk to a lawyer, and that lawyer could walk in and shut me down because I hadn't paid them. If I don't pay my telephone bill, if I don't pay this bill, that bill, it's over. So you sweat bullets when you're running a business. It's all great. I'm my own owner. I run my own company. Well, not really, because if you don't pay your bills, you'll find out the answer to that age-old philosophical question, who's your daddy? You'll find out they are the debt holders. As a debt holder, you have power beyond your wildest dreams. So remember that. If you borrow or if you sell, or if you borrow or if you lend, it's always better to be the lender, because then you get to have their Bible to sell on Craigslist. Oh, I know. I wanted to bring up something here with these bonds, and I couldn't remember what it was. When I talk about a bond in this class. There's going to be different features a bond has. One of those features would be the coupon rate. You'll probably need to know the name of the company, at least its trading symbol. When it, I said 30 years here, usually it's written in terms of the date. Like this is a March 30, 2032 bond or 2033 bond, something like that. You'll know how long it is to expiry on the bond, the maturity date. There's one other thing that is very important that they aren't going to tell you, but you know, because it is always going to be the case unless someone says differently. Bonds are issued in denominations with face value $1,000. Face value, unless I ever say differently, is $1,000. So every bond issue is a multiple of $1,000. So if I were to tell you that I've got an AMR 8% 2033 price at $98.75, you know very well that, first of all, on the maturity date in 2033, that bond has to pay $1,000 or a multiple of that. But it's $1,000 is how we work it. You know that. I never have to say that. You know it. $1,000. Now, when I say $98.75 on a bond, that means $987.50. We quote at a tenth of the actual price. So if I told you that a bond was selling at 101.35, that means that if you bought one of these bonds, you would pay $1,013.50. Quote is not the price. I had a guy I knew years ago, he wanted to do investments, but he had been buying stocks. He went and he bought a bond. It was something like 97.12. And he nearly had a heart attack when they had deducted $971.20 from his account. What the hell is this? He didn't understand that the quote is a tenth of what he bought, what he agreed to pay. So when you see me talking about bonds, you're going to hear me. I'll try to remember to talk in these terms, but eventually I want you to revert to knowing that I talk in quote. I want you to give me answers in quotes. I'll be pretty merciful at first. And on a quiz, I'll just warn you, for God's sake, be sure to write me the quote, not the dollar price, so that you don't get it wrong. So if I say, quote me the bond, and you get on your calculator $1,013.50, your answer to me has to be $101.35. I said, quote me the bond. Okay, just know that little odd difference. But always the face value is $1,000. Okay, now let me take you, I started this out with risk and return, risk and expected return, that whole thing. Now we're going to put it into a little bit of practice with a little bit of math. And this is math that will be on your first quiz. So don't make a mistake here. Know how to do it. If you don't know how to do it, well, you're dead. Oh, well. No. And I'll do these with the actual prices instead of the quotes just for this first round. But when I do this math, I want to bring up, and I can't remember whether I did this and told you this in the first lecture. Do you have a car? For some reason, that doesn't surprise me with you. Get a car, you know? You have a car? Okay. Now, the car is worth some money, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, now, let's talk. Woman, I need you to take me to the fast food place. I'm going to splurge. It's no McDonald's. Let's go to Burger King, okay? You know, do they still have that creepy-ass Burger King guy? Yeah, okay. We're good. Okay, let's go to Burger King, okay? Now, you said you got a car and it's worth some money, so let's use that to buy our food. No. Well, yeah, actually, it doesn't matter whether you say no or not. They're going to say no. What the hell? You know, buy three Whoppers, one for you and two for me, and fries, and they won't take the car in exchange for it? Well, hell, that kind of sucks. Yeah. Okay, fine. You'll go with me. That hat. I mean, that's got to be worth what? 12 cents? You know, we can use. Never mind. Okay, back to you. Maybe that shirt, it clashes with everything in the universe. I mean, it's got to be worth something.
School spirit.
Oh, is that what that said? Okay. Yeah, school spirit and all that. Okay. Man, that's got to be worth what? 58 cents, 60 cents?
It was $10.
Will you get that for it? If you sold it right now on eBay? If you traded it for a burger, would they give you that much for it?
No.
Probably not. Here's the problem. No, not even probably. Well, you got a lot of... Okay, you're a very wealthy young man. You got money invested in stocks. You got a stock certificate with you. 100 shares of Facebook. That's got to be worth $5. Okay? So we can use that to buy our food, right?
No.
Probably not. You see, here's the idea. Liquidity. Many assets have value. But liquidity is what determines how quickly you can turn one asset into another asset. Your stock has value. But it is not liquid. It is illiquid. Illiquid. So it's even though you could eventually turn it into another asset, like food or money, not right away. Here is a highly liquid asset. These are highly liquid. I can immediately turn these into something else. I can turn them into food. Friends. hell, a girlfriend. No, for an hour. Okay, a half an hour. You know what? Anyway, liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be turned into another asset or converted to another asset. That is different from value. A house has a lot of value, unless it's a toilet like most of you live in, but it doesn't have liquidity. I cannot quickly turn it into a burger and fries. Or into money, even. I can't even turn it into cash immediately. It has low, or if I wanted to turn it into cash very quickly, I would suffer a major hit. I would have to give up a lot of the value in it to turn it over. However, we have other things that have more liquidity. Cash has liquidity, high liquidity. That's why we like to have banks have cash. So that we know that they have that degree of liquidity, that ability to turn that asset into another asset quickly. Now there is another asset, the most liquid assets. The most liquid assets would be cash. And then, interestingly enough, another one that is as good as cash are T-bills. The problem with T-bills is that they cannot be, they are, in bank terms, they are as good as cash because the government won't default. You are going to get your money. You could go to the Treasury, but you couldn't use them at a burger place. Now, interestingly enough, when we're talking about liquidity, in the same realm of liquidity, what in economics we call M1, there's a minor one called traveler's checks, which are as good as cash, and they misspell it with two L's, but that's because it comes from Britain, where they spell it with two L's. They are like cash as well. So these are the most liquid instruments, cash, T-bills, and traveler's checks. And they constitute the money supply we call M1, the most liquid money in our economy. Now, let me take these off the board. The traveler's checks are really not very important anymore. They used to be pretty big, but not anymore. Okay, now, so a bank would, in its tier one capital, the capital that shows that it can efficiently satisfy its obligations, you would have the bank's cash and its T-bills, essentially perfectly substitutable. Now, the way the Federal Reserve works, and we'll get into this in the next lecture, the Federal Reserve uses a bank's cash and T-bills and the Federal Reserve's cash and T-bills to control the money supply through open market operations. But again, that's the next lecture. So for right now, liquidity, cash and T-bills, those are the most liquid. Then we go down the line, and you can talk about other things that are not as liquid, but they can you can still get them out. Like, for example, demand deposits. They're fairly liquid, too. In other words, checking accounts at banks. Not checking accounts at credit unions, because checking accounts at credit unions, the credit union doesn't have to satisfy on demand a check, a credit union check. But you have demand deposits would be in here, too. Bank checking accounts, what we call demand deposits, they are. And then going down from there, you have small time deposits. Small CDs would be not as liquid, but you could get your money out, but you'd pay a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. You also then go down from there, you have very large time deposits, and I'm talking about massive, hundreds of millions, billions. Down from there, you have the euro dollars, which is a term for money of one country in another country's central bank. The Chinese People's Republic of China has a mass of American dollars. Those are called euro dollars that the Bank of China can use, but not efficiently. And of course, our biggest, we have a lot of money. Canada has a lot of our of euro dollars that are American. Arab states do. Japan, to some extent, does. Okay, so going down from there, and then there are a lot of assets that we don't even talk about. They're very illiquid. Your house is an asset, very illiquid. Oh, here's one that's interesting. Your ass is an asset. You have value. I mean, the interesting thing, though, is that if I try to extract all of your value instantly, I'd probably get the price of whatever in you is valuable, maybe about a buck. I know that's kind of depressing, but if you slowly use that asset, you can generate a lot of money with it. You know, your paycheck every week, every month, or whatever it is. Over a long period of time, you can realize a great deal out of yourself. But if I try to liquidate it all at once, you know, with a meat grinder kind of thing, what am I going to get? You know, dude burger. And it won't be worth that much. Anyway, well, maybe with cheese, lettuce, tomato. No, not even there. A lot of ketchup, maybe. Okay. So, I mean, you're talking about assets that many of the assets we think of are extraordinarily valuable, but liquidating them, you'd lose a whole lot of value if you tried to wipe it out all at once. That's one of the things that's interesting about when debt holders think about destroying a corporation because the corporation hasn't paid its bills. They have to think to themselves, okay, the court's going to say to us, they're protected by the court in Chapter 11. Court's going to say to the bad debt holders, work something out with them if you want to. Now, the debt holders could just sit back and say, no, we just want our bill paid. But if they do that, they're going to end up having the corporation handed over to them, and they're just going to have to liquidate it for pennies on the dollar. But if they are willing to work with the company and reorganize their debt, do a reorg, a lot of watch over the company and all that kind of stuff, make sure they don't screw up again, then they may be able to extract a lot more value, something a lot closer to what they were owed if they do it that way than if they just go in and plow it down. So that's that whole idea. Sometimes liquidity isn't all there is to the story. Liquidity gets you your burger, but value is what gets you your long-term investment back. Let's go to an exercise here. I'm going to use a one-year T-bill. That is a treasury bill. Now, it's called a bill because it's a year. It's not 5 years, 20 years, 80 years. It's a very short-term instrument. Now, interestingly enough, with T-bills, they work in what's called discount fashion. So when you buy a T-bill at a treasury auction, you're buying something that in 1 year will pay you $1,000, and then it's over. So when you go to a treasury auction, you are going to pay a price for the T-bill. And then in 1 year, the face value pays off, and that is $1,000. So whatever price you pay, the difference between that and the face value is the amount of interest that you earn. And then from there, we're going to calculate the yield, and I'll get to that in a minute. But first, what we have to do is we have to have a treasury auction. Now, they're all electronic now, but we still even use the old terminology. The treasury borrows money literally by used to put paper on the table. Treasury bills, treasury notes, treasury bonds. And then wealthy institutions, nations, people would buy these instruments on the table, which effectively was lending the government money for its operations. That's how it works even to this day, except there's no table. But we're going to have it so that there's actually an auction with a table, and it's going to be a T-bill auction. And at this T-bill auction, you, sir, walk in. And you are kind of kicking tires of T-bills looking for one that suits you. Now, I am the cashier, the sales lady. My name is Mabel. Well, how are you doing there? You looking to buy a T-bill today? Well, that's nice. We got some very nice ones here. And I think this one's pretty. It goes with your eyes. Oh, those eyes of yours. My goodness, it's a wonder you haven't gotten laid yet. Okay. you want to buy a T-bill? Well, good. I mean, you'll get $1,000 in 1 year. So right now, we're seeing if we can sell them for $975. And you'll get $1,000 back in 1 year. So do you want to buy one? Earl! One T-bill! And so you buy this T-bill for a price of $975, which means that you have just lent the government $975, and the government guarantees that you will get $1,000 1 year from today. So what's your dollar interest? How much interest in 1 year you get a check for? He gets a check for $1,000. So what's his dollar interest he earned? Yeah, $25. That's not complicated. I mean, seriously, noobs. 1,000 minus 90. Anyway, okay. So now we got to do the yield, which is how much you got in interest divided by how much you invested. So the yield would be $25 divided by, what would I put here? If you say $1,000, I will give you a turbo wedgie. You didn't invest $1,000, you invested $975. I promise you that on the quiz, I will have the answer that you would get if you put $1,000 down there. And you will get no credit for it. You invested $975. So a yield is interest earned over investment made. So in this case, and I would really strongly encourage you to do this on your calculator, 25 divided by 975. There's some reason this calculator. Oh, I guess I got to turn it on. Okay, here we go. I don't know why they want that. 2.56% interest. Now, remember what I told you. two decimal places, always, whether it's a percentage or whatever it is, and some things are percentages, some things are factors that you calculate in this class, always you report two decimal places, rounded, always. So it's a 2.56% yield on this T-bill. Now let's try it. At the end of 1 year, you have gone back, you've done your thing, you got your 1,000, and here you are back again. Well, I'll be darned, you got your $1,000, and you're coming back for another one. Isn't that nice? Well, we got these T-bills here, and we're asking $975 again. You look around, you know what? I don't see any son of a bitch in this room except me buying. I'll give you $950 for it. You see, because as the demand goes down, the price should go down. Also, if I'm borrowing more, the government's got tons of them on there, the supply goes up, the price is going to go down as well. Supply and demand dynamics. You remember that for the first quiz. So you, oh, okay, well, $950, that sounds nice. Did you ever find a girlfriend? Oh, you work at Penn State. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to hell for that. $950. What's the face value? So help me God. What is always the face value of any debt instrument? $1,000. So how much interest did he earn after a year on this one? $50. So now we can find the yield, $50 over $950. Do that one. Is there some reason I can't key? 5.26%. Well, isn't that interesting? As the price goes down, the yield goes up. That is going to be true of all securities. The lower the price, the higher the yield. Price and yield are always inversely related. The cheaper it is, the higher the yield will be. And the more expensive it is, the lower the yield will be. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.